you there. I'm not going to block it since the other people want to take a stand. Enter it.
What percentage of the modern-day scopes have a flash drive, either on the front panel or the back panel? Glenn, go ahead.
Dick, I think I'm going to be a little forward on this one, but I'd say I think they all do. It's just that what happens is they're an option. So when you're looking at any of these series of the new digitized oscilloscopes, every one of them has the option. So it's just a matter of making sure that that option is selected for that particular model of the oscilloscope, because about 5 to 10 years ago, the standard was the floppy disk. Now everybody plugs in the old 3.5 floppy. Well, that's kind of gone away and never to return, so to speak, and everybody uses a flash drive today. Well, you can slip this little memory flash drive in your pocket. It's got the USB plug on the other end. You plug it right into the oscilloscope, and when you hit the print function, instead of going to a printer, you can have it set up so it prints right to the USB port, and it's stored right on your flash drive. And then now you can plug it into virtually any computer, and you've got the images right on there. And you can usually choose a JPEG output, TIFF, whatever you want to work with. So they're a very, very handy port to have. And it's just a matter of just, making sure that that scope has that that port on it. Just like in the old days, you used to be able to choose a Centronics port as an option for the computer. And more and more of those have kind of disappeared, and USB has kind of taken over today. K2RIW, KC2QAQ.
Let me pick it up, Dick, for a moment.
You got it, Wesley.
Okay, since I have you, could you tell me, if I have a oscilloscope, let's say it's a 3 gigahertz oscilloscope, and mostly the maximum that I need is 500, and then some of the oscilloscopes, they have a switchable frequency, the maximum frequency, 50, 500, whatever, the 3 gig. Question is, if I'm buying the high frequency oscilloscope, then is it understandable automatically that the lower end will be kind of limited to the amount of information that I can analyze with this?
I don't think so, Wesley. Generally, as the scopes get higher in frequency, what happens, it just means that your waveforms are going to look sharper when you go to the lower and lower, to the smaller and smaller time bases. So when you start opening up that oscilloscope, the higher frequency range you have, the better those images are going to look. Basically, what happens is that the vertical amplifier on the input where you're plugging your scope probe into, if the scope doesn't have enough bandwidth, eventually the waveforms start getting smoothed over. But if you back off on the time base, and you're at the at slower sweep speeds on the oscilloscope, those waveforms will probably look fine. So it's basically the frequency bandwidth is really the wave shape of the signals coming in through your scope probe or through your coaxial cable or however you're feeding it in to get the true sharpness and true pictures of spikes and short duration pulses.
And let me add something to Glenn on this one. The modern digital oscilloscopes, if he's got the ability to buy full capability, 5 gigs when he only needs 500 megs, and if the scope has got enough processing built into it, he can then integrate. He can tell it to store that waveform, put 16 of them on top of each other as a spectral overlay, and therefore average 16 consecutive identical events. And you'll get a beautiful sharp rise time, high resolution, smooth curve. Some of them also have a bandwidth limiting button on the front panel where you can force it to go down to a more narrow bandwidth. But I think the integrating function or the spectral overlay function is so darn valuable that buying higher frequency capability is probably a good investment if you have enough dollars. That's an opinion. Wonder how you feel on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, there's two things you're going to really pay dearly for in an oscilloscope. One is going to be the higher the frequency of the oscilloscope, and the other thing is going to be the storage depth. In other words, how much recording time of that waveform and dot can you store? As those two numbers go up, certainly the oscilloscope is going to give you cleaner and sharper pictures and more overlay capability and everything. I mean, certainly, but the dollars are going to go up along with it. But today I would say your typical 500 megahertz scope, if you don't have to do anything look at things much faster than that, and you're not looking at like 1 nanosecond type things. You know, it's probably, you know, looking at waveform rise time and fall times is like, say, 250 nanoseconds. A 500 megahertz scope is probably fast enough. And, you know, unless you're really, really, you know, looking at extremely sharp pulses, then you're going to have to pay a premium to get to those much higher frequencies and much more more storage depth thick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In the old days of an analog oscilloscope, a rough rule of thumb was 0.3 divided by bandwidth is the rise time, 10% to 90% point. Now that the front end of the scope is a, now that the front end of the scope is an analog to digital converter, does that rough rule of thumb for calculating rise time still hold? And I guess we don't have to calculate it. Hopefully the manufacturer tells you the rise time. Now back to you, Glenn.
One more thing before I pick up. Glenn, the Tektronix usually use the digital phosphor oscilloscope. That's the standard with them, and then LaCroix doesn't use that, and they have much better much better quality with the signal. I just don't get it. Could you enlighten me in this matter, please?
Well, to answer Dick's question first, that are they compatible in terms of ratings? Yes, they are. I would say as far as you know, the way that you specified it, Dick. The only thing that's really different with a digitized scope is really the display. Because instead of getting a line drawn across phosphor, you're getting points. And the more points that you have, creating that picture is going to give you better resolution on the screen. Now, to what Wesley's saying is that, well, does LaCroix give you more points across a larger display? Yeah, I'd say that they do. So you're getting a lot more integrated points, and they do. I think that they've spent a little bit more time and money on their displays. And you know, certainly, if you need to really look at something clean on a big screen, I really kind of favor the LaCroix. But that doesn't mean you can't make very good measurements on the Tektronix. For dollar per dollar, I think you get a little bit more oscilloscope with the Tektronix. But there again, I don't think the display is going to be as clear. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to screen capture, assuming that there's enough calculating capability inside where it can give you A minus B functions, and spectral overlays, integrations, and true RMS, peaks and valleys, and peak hold and valley hold and whatever, capturing that screen with all of its screen markings, with all of its digitized data printed out and whatever, for a report, once you set the screen up correctly, that's very valuable. I think the ability to restore, to store the waveform itself, the digitized waveform, independent of the screen, and therefore you do calculating on your external computer, I'd like to believe that that's no longer very required. That the built-in calculating functions on a modern-day digital oscilloscope is so good that pure screen capture is going to fulfill your documenting requirement 95% of the time. That's my feeling. I wonder how you feel on that one, Glenn. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
I'll agree with that to the point of looking at repetitive signals. If you're looking at sine waves, square waves, very repetitive waveforms, I believe that's true. When you get mixed signal waveforms, I think that now you're going to need more and more storage depth in the oscilloscope to give you enough dots to to give you the best picture closer to your analog scope. And what do I mean by mixed signal? Let's say from just my own experience here, looking at a power supply ripple, you've got a fundamental sawtooth kind of waveform, which is the ripple that might be like say 20 millivolts in amplitude. But you've got a spike waveform on the output ripple that's a kind of like a common mode signal, but the differential measurement is showing it up around 100 millivolts. Now, when you look at the lower, and then you may have even some small 60 cycle inside there as well. When you start slowing down the sweep so that you're trying to integrate the 60 cycle ripple with the high-frequency sawtooth and then the spike riding on top of it, as you slow down the scan rate, the picture that you get kind of looks, if you don't have enough storage depth in the oscilloscope, it starts looking all mashed together like a bunch of fun. In other words, you don't get a really good picture anymore. So there again, storage depth will definitely distinguish, give you more points to distinguish the difference between the spike, the fundamental, and the 60 cycle ripple all put together. So you get a little bit better picture there. So that's another good reason to have a lot of storage depth. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
And also the real day sampling, that is actually how many points you have per one signal, full signal. But the sampling over the long period of signal when you have repeating sine waves, that is actually that I'm not interested with that. What I need is just I get a single wave form, and I need to know have the most of that. Back to you, Dick.
Yep. Not an easy set of solutions. Not an easy set of decisions coming. I see it coming. We better go over to Bill for keeping up awful late. KB1IFY. Go right ahead, Bill. Hope you're still there. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, KB1IFY. Yeah, no. Now, when I say my question sort of ties in with the questions you guys are talking about now. My question's on a spectrum analyzer. I don't know if any of you guys are experts on them, but I'd give it a try. Back to you, Dick.
That's a good subject. Go right ahead, Bill.
When I was working, I had a couple of them at the shop I worked at. I had the old Motorola one. I don't remember the exact model, if it was like a 2008, 2009, one with the LEDs. It looks like the one Andy uses at the clinic, the tune-up clinic. I acquired one that was a 2400, and I don't know if that one is as good as the one like Andy uses, or if the one he uses is a better unit.
Bill, you used the word spectrum analyzer, but I think you really mean performance monitor. What is it called now? IFI is the one of the popular brands that the 2400 you're talking about is. It's a
service monitor.
That's the word I'm looking for, service monitor. So I think you're talking about a service monitor, and you're probably talking about the spectrum analyzer function of a service monitor. Is that true, Bill? Go ahead.
Yeah, the ones I'm talking about were made by Motorola. I did have an IFR 120 COM-B also that, which I know is a new unit. But my question is on the Motorola's, the one like Andy uses, it's a 2000, I don't know the exact model number of his, but it looks like a 2008, 2009. I noticed some of the older ones. The one I picked up was the 2400, which has this little scope. It's got 2 meters. The other one had the one scope with the LEDs. I don't know if you guys are familiar with those.
Okay, you've now pinned down the fact that you're about to ask a question on the spectrum analyzer function of a Motorola service monitor model 2400. Go right ahead with your question, Bill.
Yeah, my question is the 2400 a better model, or do you... In anybody's opinion that's on here now, or do you think the one that the other model with the LEDs, it's a 2008, maybe 2009, is a better model?
The kind of display is not important. The important is the range of the swooping.
Yeah, the spectrum analyzer itself, some of the things you care about are how many decibels of vertical resolution does it have, or dynamic range, and how many different settings can you get for the resolution bandwidth and the scan width, or as it's sometimes called the dispersion for the scan width. I wish Andy was on frequency, or maybe Eric, either Eric or Andy, who spend quite a bit of time on this repeater throughout the day. Either one of them can give you exact information as to the goods and the bads of the various brands and model numbers. Let's see if anybody with experience with Motorola and IFR and similar service monitor spectrum analyzer function. If you've got some hands-on experience with that, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. It appears that the smart guys on that particular subject may not be here. I worked for a division of a company that built and designed a spectrum analyzer, and I was heavily involved in the design of that. So when it comes to good spectrum analyzer design functions with a good pre-selecting filter, and hopefully the Yig filter, when it comes to a microwave spectrum analyzer, I've got a fair amount of familiarity with that one, Bill. But when it comes to the commercially available service monitor products, there I don't have very much experience, I'm sorry to say. Both Andy, WA2CDL, and Eric, KE2EJ, Kilo Echo 2 Echo Juliet. You will hear both of those guys on 10 times during the average day on this repeater. When you hear one of those guys on, and you start up a conversation with them, I think there's a 90% chance you're going to get some of the information you're looking for. Back to you, Bill. KB1IFY, I don't think we gave you much of an answer. Kicked you out of IW in the tech net.
All right, very good. I know Andy personally. In fact, I was out there at Los Angeles. I believe you were over there talking to him. I didn't meet you, but I think you were one of the guys talking to Andy at the table over there. I came over with my wife. We were the ones from Connecticut. I don't know if you remember or not. There was a guy there most of the time, which I think might have been you. I'm not 100% sure, but I did use the other Motorola style like he has. And when I worked for the city down here taking care of the radio system, I did use that IFR for a short time. I know the IFRs are real good. The Motorola's are older equipment, so... All right, very good. Okay, maybe I'll try... I do have Andy's phone number and stuff, or I have his email address, so that's not a problem there. Or maybe Eric might have a different answer. All right, very good. I'll turn it back to you, Dick. KB1IFY.
DA7DPF.
Bill, yes, I was there at the last flea market of Limock at the... Briarcliff College. Was it? No. That was at Levittown Hall. And yes, I'm the guy in the black shirt that was sitting behind the table with Andy. So you probably saw me, and I think I do remember you introducing your wife to me. So you and I have met face to face. We've had an eyeball, as they say, Bill. And hopefully Andy or Eric will be able to give you a lot more information. We better go over to the mailbag. It's awful late. I know. We're not doing a good job on that one. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW, what's the major burning question this week, other than the Smith chart question, which is going to be a tough one? We're going to have to chew on that one a little bit longer. You got it, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Get a lot of questions, you know. Give us a simple answer. Tell us how to simply do this, how to fix this, or whatever. So. Number of young hams, you know, get very confused easily, of course, with a lot of this technology, and try to keep it simple. And I'm just looking through here, and some of these are very complicated questions and all about things that I don't think that we'll be able to get into at this time because it's going to run very late. Oh, wait a minute. Here's one from a young person. Because I can tell that he's trying to build some little gadget, and he's run into a difficulty, and he'd like to know a simple way out of this difficulty. So maybe we can give him some help, Dick. Over.
Fire away, Bill.
Okay, I'm building a little project, and I'm working with a thing called FET. Okay, and I'd like to know, is there a simple way I could tell if the FET or JFET is good or bad? Is there a simple way of making a little checker to tell me whether or not this one of these little devices is really usable or not usable? I think I know of something, but... not sure. Any suggestions? Over.
Yeah, to start off with the data sheet is going to be very helpful. Once you've got a model number of the transistor, and you simply put that into a Google search, nothing but that number, 2N such and such, and such or 3N such and such, most of the time you'll get a data sheet. And some of the variables involved are is it a the equivalent of an NPN or a PNP? That's one of the variables. Is it a positive type or a upside down type, as I call it? Second of all, is it an enhancement mode or a depletion mode? The majority of transistors that we get a hold of these days are what I call a depletion mode. In other words, if there is 0 volts between the source and the gate, most transistors will give you maximum conductivity between source and drain, and your ohm meter will show that to you. And then, for most transistors, you have to put a couple of volts of negative voltage on the gate with reference to the source in order for the transistor to not be in the full on mode, but to go into the off mode. So an ohm meter from source to drain with the gate voltage either zero or a couple of volts negative is an extremely strong indication of proper transistor operation for a FET transistor. For the majority of transistors which are so-called depletion mode, in other words, the transistor is naturally on and you have to turn it off with a negative voltage on the gate. There are a few power transistors which are enhancement mode, which means the transistor is naturally off until you put a positive voltage on the gate in order to turn it on. But quite often you can tell by the size of the heatsink whether or not it is likely to be an enhancement mode. The data sheet will tell you that right away. So that's one simple test I can think of. I bet you you've got even better ones, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, well, I can think of one. I made up many years ago, you know, a lot of simple instruments I had to have. That had to be handy and everything, and it had to be simple. And for MOSFET, JFET, types of devices like that, I took a little socket so I could plug them in easily enough, and I made up a little circuit that they would oscillate. In other words, it was told me if they're good or, you know, rejected or they're no good, because if it wouldn't oscillate, I would assume that it was a defective device, Dick. So basically, that's what it was. It was a simple little use of one of those devices as an oscillator over.
Now, did you make that into a RC phase shift type oscillator? Did you make it into a Colpitts? I'll bet you made it into something like a Hartley or a Colpitts oscillator. Is that true? And then pass it over to Wesley. You got it, Mel.
I think I made a Colpitts oscillator out of it. Very, very simple. I remember with a little inductor. I remember using a little choke in there and a few resistors. And I think, I don't remember, a few odds and ends, and plugged a pair of headphones in. And if you hear it oscillate, I remember it had a 9-volt battery in it. So if you hear it oscillate, usually, pretty good indication that it's a working device. Go ahead, Wesley.
I just reminded myself 20, 30 years ago, actually, with a simple ohmometer, germanium type of transistors, PNP and PN, I was able to actually check if they are good for with reversing the polarity and on the ohmometer, finding at that time if it was better. But years ago, I didn't do it for 20 years. Anyhow, then there was a transition to FET and MOSFET. Back to you, the Gantuja.
Yeah, Wesley's got a good point. In the case of bipolar transistors, NPN and PNP, again, the data sheet might be required, but even without the data sheet, well, the data sheet in some cases is going to be required for you to recognize what the three leads are, which one's the emitter, base, and collector, or which one's the source, gate, and drain, and it's a FET. But in the case of bipolar transistor, the emitter base is a diode. The base collector is another diode, and the common lead is the base. The base is the one between the two. So you should measure the same polarity of diode action when you go from base to collector or base to emitter. And then by reversing the ohm meter leads, you'll find out that in one direction the diode is forward biased, in the other direction the diode is back biased. So you've now confirmed those two junctions. A third test required. You have to go from emitter to collector, in other words, across the whole device in at least one direction, to prove that there isn't a punch-through failure. One of the methods by which a bipolar transistor fails is that the emitter gets shorted to the collector. But it's called a punch-through failure because in some cases, the measurement of the emitter-base junction will look almost normal. The measurement of the base collector junction will look like a normal diode. Both of those are diode actions that you should see. And yet, you'll get a perfect short circuit, a fraction of an ohm, from source to drain. And that, of course, is a useless device. With FETs, though, it's a little bit more complicated because many of them are the so-called depletion mode. In other words, the transistor is fully on until you put a negative voltage on its gate to turn it off. An ohm meter will confirm that, but you need another 1 or 2 volt power supply, so to speak. A pen light battery with a resistor can easily do that for you. K2KEY, K2LIW.
KC2QIQ.
Let's see how Glenn solves that problem. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, actually, the test that I would perform, not for that for that type, but for enhancement mode MOSFETs, is to use a simple volt ohmmeter, because in an enhancement mode MOSFET, typically the gate will trigger somewhere like between 1.5 to about 3.5 volts, it will turn on. Granted, if you completely saturate the transistor, you need like 10 volts, but it's really not required just to check the power enhancement mode power MOSFET. If you have a digital ohmmeter, you can put it on the ohm scale and go between the gate to the source and apply. You're basically putting the positive lead on the gate and the negative lead on the source. Then you move the positive lead from the gate over to the drain. So now you're measuring drain to source, and it should reach a short circuit or very close to a very, very low impedance, the audiosonic of the transistor. Let me let it drop for a second.
Are you saying the gate fault stays there while you're making the source-to-drain measurement?
Yes, it does. And then what you can do is once you see that when you've used the ohmmeter, to when you're going from the gate to the source to charge it, and you'll see a short between drain to source, which is kind of neat. Then if you reverse the leads, so now you're putting the negative lead on the gate and the positive lead on the source, and then go back and try to measure the drain to source again, and it should read an open. And actually, in between that measurement, the gate will hold the charge, and basically you can take the measurement between drain to source to see the open and the close. And that's a very, very easy way to test an enhancement mode MOSFET. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
A really good enhancement mode where the gate is many megohms to ground, I'm going to agree with you. But I could have a gate-to-ground leakage resistance of 10 kiloohms in my circuit, my power circuit, that might be a perfectly good transistor, but I'm a little bit afraid that the gate voltage would drain away too fast for you to do that particular test, in which case you could put a small capacitor between gate and source in order to get around that. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, I haven't found the power MOSFET enhancement mode power MOSFET that had a gate to drain resistance, internal resistance of 10K. If I did, I would probably suspect that that's a bad MOSFET. I mean, if you have a data sheet on one or one you could steer me to that has that low impedance of gate to drain, I'd be really interested in seeing it. As a matter of fact, most of those enhancement modes, that capacitive barrier is a very, very small capacitance. It's in the picofarads, and the amount of charge is very, very small, but it's interesting, the impedance is in the mega ohms. But as I said, I haven't really come across an enhancement mode MOSFET yet with a 10K ohm gauge drain impedance. So I would say for everyone that I've ever seen, that test works very, very well. But there again, if you have more information about enhancement mode MOSFETs with extremely low, you know, gate to drain impedances, I'd like to know a little bit more about them. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, you speculated about a gate to drain leakage resistance. I meant gate to source. Because of the way a power MOSFET is usually used, if I had only picofarads on the gate capacitance to the rest of the world, and if the gate to source resistance was 500 kilo-ohms, it would drain away that voltage in a fraction of a second. You wouldn't get a chance to do that ohmmeter test. And yet 500 kilo-ohms of gate to source leakage resistance might be a perfectly usable device. I know in some cases gate to source 500 kilo-ohms probably indicates a latent failure that's going to give you trouble downrange. But other than that, it might be a thoroughly useful device with 500 kilo-ohms gate to source. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, here again, Dick. I don't think I've ever seen a gate-to-source resistance on a power MOSFET that was a functioning power enhancement mode MOSFET that was even functioning. I would imagine that if there was some kind of breakdown like that, it probably wasn't long for this world. Not to say that there isn't something out there, maybe an older style that exists someplace, but as I said, I've never really come across one. But there again, if you wanted to use an external power supply, you know, sometimes I think an external fixture where you have a resistor in series and an external power supply where you basically, would really need a dual power supply with resistors in series, and you can apply a positive gate voltage to see if it matches datasheet performance. But that would probably be the only other thing, would be to use the external power supply with dual output voltage in series resistors. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Let's see what Mel's got to say about all this. You got him, Mel.
Hey, this is KEY. Well, simplest method I found is, I took a little socket and do a good device, I marked it off, knowing the basing of the device and drain. Saw gate 2, gate 1, put it in there, listen, oscillate. I could honestly say I think it's going to be a working device, especially this is for small little projects where they call for a MOSFET. So nothing elaborate that you need, I think, for just a go-no-go. And also at the same time identifies directly if you have the right leads, especially the drain and the source stick over.
Comment.
Go ahead, Wesley.
It's good to be talking about it because pretty soon I'm going to be dealing with MOSFETs, power MOSFETs, and Meissner generator and Tesla coil. Actually, Glenn, I have a question for you. I'm going to be having anywhere between 15 kilovolts to 20 kilovolts from the Tesla coil, and there are probes. I saw on eBay 15 kilovolts per probe for the oscilloscope. I mean, I want to know what's going on over there. What do you suggest? Glenn, back to you, I think, Jack.
Wow, high voltage measurements. Yeah, they're always tricky ones, Wesley. Unfortunately, there again, you need, I'm not even sure I'm aware of that I've ever used a voltage probe for an oscilloscope that measures voltages that high. I personally use typically oscilloscope probes that maybe are good to, you know, a few hundred volts, and then I have like a high voltage one that I have that's maybe good to maybe 4 kV. But when you start getting, you know, to, you know, voltages that you're mentioning right there, that's kind of out of my area of expertise. That's something you probably want to ask around about, and I do know a few people that have worked in high power supply companies like Spelman and you know, some of the other ones here on the island, and how they got around that was using very, very high impedance resistor dividers, where they got like 0.1 ohm 0.1% resistors, a very, very high ohm impedance, and then made a divider, and then attached their oscilloscope to that divider to make those kinds of measurements. But here again, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question for you.
Well, K2YZ, K2YO, or N2YO. If that's you, Bernie, give it a try, but anything you do to increase the signal would help.
Okay, Dick, how am I coming through now?
Tremendous improvement. Go ahead, Bernie.
Okay, I just had to make the break with RF, and now I'm on Echo Link. Wesley, if you look up the call sign N6USW, Nancy 6 Union X-Ray Williams, a gentleman named Bill Weissach is a premier Tesla coil builder. If you'd like, contact me off the list. I can give you contact information for him, and I think he'd be willing to help you out with this issue.
You've got it, Wesley.
Okay, I put N6UNW. Did I put it right?
He said November 6th, uniform, X-ray, whiskey. And I think what you're possibly trying to do is measure peak voltage and waveform out of a Tesla coil. And if that's true, they do make a kind of extremely high voltage probe for something like an oscilloscope. And it looks like a lens, in other words, a jousting lens is what the thing looks like. It's a foot long. It's got a big fancy handle at one end and a grounding clip. And some of them have a fancy kind of high voltage transformer oil inside in order to give it the breakdown characteristics. And when you use that probe on a Tesla coil, you got to worry a little bit about what I call the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The probe is going to have some number of ohms, hopefully many, many megohms, and some number of picofarads, and that's going to slightly change the characteristic of the Tesla coil. Back to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Yep. You've got it right. There was another station that I heard, but was breaking up. Dick, back to you, and then to another station.
Yeah, I'm hearing Mr. ILP, I think it's Bob, and I believe the Eastern machine is not working well tonight. We're going to try to hear you on the Western machine. Don't talk too loud, Bob, otherwise you keep chopping out of the machine. ILP, go right ahead.
This is W2ILP, and I don't know how accurately you want to measure the high voltage, but your common probes made or the old DTVMs and oscilloscopes that measured voltages from CRT anodes that were up to over 50,000 volts. And these things had, they were long probes with rippled insulation on them. And so you would hold them at an extreme end away from the contact point with the anode. And you could measure voltages that were for the large CRT anodes. And there was no oil or anything in them. What they had was many megohms of film resistor.
Connected.
Usually several resistors in series. And I don't imagine they measured more accurately than 10% or 5% maybe at best, but that's what they did. Back to you, Dick, from W2ILP.
Very fine, Bob. And yes, I've seen one of those probes. As I said, it's a foot and a half. It's a great big long thing. It looks like the lance that's used for a jousting event. You know, two guys on horses with armor on, and they aim these things at each other, and the horses come to each other head to head, so to speak, across this barrier. The probe looks like that. Now, the good news about the AC output of a Tesla coil is that it has very little DC voltage. It's primarily an AC voltage. That gives you one huge advantage, Wesley, and that is by a capacitor divider network, you can measure that voltage with more normal scope probe. The ring that you've got on the top of a Tesla coil over to a small test capacitor. In other words, a metallic plate that's, say, a tenth of a centimeter square, and you hold it a foot away, and you can calculate the amount of picofarads, 0.001 picofarads, so to speak, of coupling between the ring on the Tesla coil and your test capacitor. That, in turn, goes into the scope probe. The scope probe has 7 picofarads to ground. Many scope probes do. And you therefore know the capacitor divider ratio, and therefore this huge voltage can be stepped down to something much smaller because you have the advantage you're measuring an AC voltage, not a DC voltage. That way you'll have much less voltage into your probe, much less loading of the circuit under test, and I think properly done, it's an art form, but properly done, I think you'll get a higher fidelity answer that way than with the most ideal high voltage scope probe, where you're trying to look at these very high frequency components with that crazy waveform that happens when arcing in the air is taking place. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2QIQ with one more comment.
Wesley first, go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, I'm going to shock you, all of you guys, because I'm not going to have AC. I'm going to have a pulsed DC. And a pulsed DC is going to be made by the spark. And so it's going to be like kind of constant sparks, and it would be pulsed DC. I will never have any AC at all. Back to you, Dick, and then Glenn.
Yeah, that is a little more difficult. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, I've got two comments in this area. One was a high voltage measurement that I made a couple of years back when I was working on a home project here, working with a couple of friends, trying to measure voltages of high performance racing engine electronic ignitions. And basically, how I did it was I took a 100 k-ohm resistor and took some very, very long vector boards. It's a long vector board. I'm talking about something that was almost like 2 feet long, and I was measuring voltages that were in the 20 kilovolt area, roughly around that area, the top of the spike of that waveform. And what I just kept on doing was building up, you know, a whole bunch of series of 100 k-ohm resistors and just kept on populating the board along the length until actually I got the voltage divider that I needed to divide down and then give me a measurement into the oscilloscope. So I was using a 400 volt, typical, oscilloscope probe, and then did it with resistor divider going all the way up, and then laid wrapped up the that resistor board with a lot of plastic around the outside, and then took clip leads and then clipped one side onto the engine block and then one side near the where I clipped onto the spark plug. Let me let drop. The results were pretty positive, so I thought that was kind of okay. Another thing to worry about is when the voltages start getting above 4 kV, the dielectrics are not as good as you think that they are, and these are measurements that you really want to kind of connect up all the leads, and while the circuit is completely off, get as far away from it as you can reasonably, like leave a good spacing, at least quite a few feet between you and the measuring circuit. Stand near the oscilloscope, move the oscilloscope into a very isolated area. If you can, run the oscilloscope off a battery while you're doing these kind of measurements on a completely insulated surface. That's probably the way you want to go there, Wesley. But be very, very careful. These are very dangerous circuits, and spacing, lots of spacing. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, there was another session. What I can say is, when I was young, I'm not young any longer, I was playing with high voltages and on daily basis, and I can say that I was hit by 20-30 kilovolts quite hundreds times, few hundreds times. I just know how to react. Not saying that I'm smart, but yes, there are a few tips that I could give to the people dealing with high voltage. And then I remember that I was working with the power lines also, that helps a lot. But I believe that I know that feeling, and I know how to behave.
Glenn, what made you use 100K resistors instead of 1 mega ohm resistors, and what was the length of those resistors? Did you worry about the voltage drop arcing through the resistor material itself? Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, the resistors that I selected, Dick, were 100K ohm resistors, and they were the half-watt series resistors, and I just kept on stacking them. And the reason I selected them was because I wasn't so much interested in the current in the divider, but I was looking at the voltage rating of the resistor. So I went to a data sheet that I had, which basically specified for the body style of the resistor, what the maximum voltage across the leads were. So what I did was I looked at something that was like, at least close to 500 volts or higher in the body size, and the half-watt resistor happens to be at least 500 volts. You can find them pretty easily. So then what you do is you just start stacking them up, and I could stack up enough of a whole series of these resistors, running them down. And the reason for selecting 100K was because when I started with 1 meg, what was happening is I was starting to get some capacitive effects to the probe, and the wave shape wasn't what I was expecting it to be. So instead of getting a loading factor, which I was worried about initially, I found out that the reaction between the impedance of the scope probe to the in parallel with 100K still gave me some good resolution into the shape of the waveform, where when I went to 1 meg, I was noticing I was starting to get some kind of like rounding in the waveform, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Dick, KC2QIQ.
Did you consider the possibility of compensating your probe? The way a scope probe works is they've got a calibrated amount of capacitance across the resistor divider network to make it flat in frequency response. It may have only required 0.1 or 0.01 picofarad capacitors across your 100K resistors to make it thoroughly compensated. And by putting a square wave at one end and looking at the wave shape coming out of the other end in the scope probe, it'll tell you pretty fast whether or not your compensation is right. That's question number one. And question number two, roughly how many 100K resistors in series? 25 of them? Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, it was roughly that. I think it's been a while ago. I have to pull out the board and take a look. A lot of other things have happened since. But it was around 25 or somewhere in that area. I sat down, I did the calculation, I figured it all out. I have a math kit file someplace where I just put everything on and calculated the voltage drop across each individual resistor. I did think about compensating the scope probe initially with the by putting series capacitors and other things in, but I guess the reason I walked away from it and I went back to the 100Ks was first I was starting to get success with 100Ks and without the loading that I was worried about. And the other thing was that when I was calibrating the scope probe, I was doing it directly on the oscilloscope and then getting the correct square, waveform by, tuning in. It was a times 10 scope probe, and I was able to get a nice calibration on the probe directly from the oscilloscope. And then when I was figuring, if I do the compensation on the resistors, making like lag and lead capacitors across the series resistors, and then I sat down and I was like, oh, well, I've got voltage breakdown problems with capacitors and other things, so I kind of like walked away from that pretty quick there, Dick. I was trying to keep it simple, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Dick. KC2QIQ.
I'm guessing that the amount of capacitance across a half-watt resistor, lead-to-lead, axial leads, is a fixed number of picofarads. Therefore, if you choose the right resistor, it becomes almost naturally compensated in your scope probe, high voltage probe characteristic. In the case of the megohm resistors, I'm guessing the capacitance is too high and you have a differentiating function going on. And the 100K may have been just the right ratio of internal natural capacitance across the 100K resistor versus its 100K of resistance. Therefore, as a series string, it almost became naturally compensated, or at least compensated within the range of where you could now readjust your scope probe and make the whole system come out flat. Was that approximately it, Glenn? Go ahead.
Right on, Dick. As you would say, give the man a cigar. That's exactly it. Basically, I just found the body of a resistor and placing it on the vector board and try to put it in a series length. You know, so as I was placing each resistor down, and I was leaving, like, say, you know, like one body width between each resistor as I went down the line. So this became like a 2-inch wide vector board with the resistors placed in the middle. And I just kept on, you know, moving the resistors down a series length. And the compensation worked out pretty well. As a matter of fact, in the beginning, what I started doing was twisting the ground wire and the wire that came off at the end of the series resistors before I attached it to the engine block of the spark plug. Ooh, boy, big mistake. You want to keep those wires as far apart as you can. There was the ground wire that was attaching to the engine block at that time, and then the wire, the clip lead that I took the spark plug wire with a boot, and I actually clipped away at the boot for the experiment so I could get a clip lead to clip onto it when I made that adjustment. And, I got fairly good results doing that, but I believe that the compensation of the resistor body itself, its characteristics to the scope probe, gave me very good results there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a question to Glenn. What material were this resistor made from? What is that you recommend, Dick?
Yeah, and also, Glenn, what do you believe was the frequency response of your homebrew high-voltage probe? Do you believe it was good to, say, 50 megacycles?
I can't give it to you in frequency, but you could probably invert the time frame, but I was looking at rise times of about, I think, 180, just under 200 microsecond rise times on the waveforms with spikes that were maybe, like, say, 25 nanosecond spikes up on the top. So it had pretty good bandwidth. It wasn't bad. It was very, very nice wave shapes that came in. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch the other question from Wesley.
Comments?
What kind of these resistors, what material these resistors are made from that you recommend are the best for it?
I'm sorry I didn't mention that, Wesley. Carbon compound only. Anything with any kind of like wire wound, RW series resistors, stay away from. Try to use, you know, carbon compound resistors. And I would also have to say that initially I was using, I think, 1-watt body resistors. And I found out that they were also good, but it was just that the board was getting too long. So I found that the half-watt one with 100K, well, you know, 100K, you know, keeping the voltage no higher than 100 volts, across 100K, you know, kind of a thing, you know what I'm saying? So you can kind of size it that way and watch the, you know, the power level. I don't think that's going to be the big problem. It's really going to be length. And but you can use 1-watt resistors. It's just that I think your board's going to get much longer than you think. And you don't want to double the resistors back on each other, if you know what I mean.
There's somebody with something to...
Yeah, this is Reggie to RLP again. Comments, am I clear? You know, there is such a thing as an electric voltmeter, and this is what the professional measurement departments use to verify high voltage, and it is only used for direct current. And it works on, I think, the principle of type of electrostatic detection that you get when the leads separate, the metallic leads separate when there's a voltage. Well, this separates the same electrostatic force that drives the meters, and they can go up very, very high. The first thought that I had, I worked in a television factory, and I many times got hit by the anode of the ceiling when I was first thing the truckers would see was when the telephone chassis come right off the line, and the first thing they do is lock the synchronization of the 15750
because both of you actually, you deal with the spark. If you have almost steady spark,